The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada and is supported by the generous donations of our listeners. If you would like to partner with us in this ministry, please go to apologeticscanada.com.
Welcome, everyone, to the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
All right. So, Terry, do you have something for us today?
Yeah, a little bit. Do you guys remember the Rubik's Cube, or is that before your time?
Buddy, Rubik's Cube is still a thing, man.
It is still a thing.
My son loves it.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He's got a
Rubik's Cube.
I've never solved one, by the way.
No.
Neither have
like,
I.
Never
it is a complete
one.
Mystery to me.
Yeah. It was formed in the 80s. I never had one, but when I got a hold of my friends, I could only do like one, maybe two sides.
The only time I ever solved one actually was when I had one that had like stickers all over it. And I just.
You took it off.
Oh, yeah. I just took each sticker off and.
I saw a lot
around.
Of people take the cubes off and then put them back together.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you guess how fast the fastest cube, Rubik's Cube, has been put together?
I'm going to say 30 seconds.
No.
I was thinking more like 45 seconds.
4.69 seconds.
Get what? Out.
Yes.
Dude, that ain't right.
I got onto this yesterday and I was just like, it took me in. Like, I'm just like, I looked at this guy and he has his hands on these timer pads. They have it covered up.
Oh, it's like that. It's like a legit, he has never seen this pattern before.
He hasn't seen this pattern. They lift it off. He grabs a cube. He looks at it just for a few seconds, puts it down when he's ready, puts his hands on the timers.
Okay, so they do let him take a look at it.
They get him to look at it, yeah. He can see it. But by the time he takes his hands off the pads, does the whole Rubik's Cube, and puts his hands back on the pad, 4.69 seconds.
That is disgusting.
Wow, man.
That's
amazing.
I can't even imagine that. Like, I can even do one side.
4.5 days, man, and I'm still at a loss.
And then I got onto this eight-year-old kid. He could do the Rubik's Cube blindfolded in less than 2 minutes.
Now, hold on.
Yeah, you should look at the videos because it is fascinating. They let him look at the cube. Okay. So he looks at it, and you could just see his mind just working. You know,
basically, he's memorizing.
He's memorizing the patterns of what he's going to do.
And then he closes his eyes and he can solve that.
He puts his mask on his head and they put a paper in front of his eyes and he just goes. And in that time where he's looked at it to the time he finished it was 2 minutes and something.
Dude, that is unreal. 8 years old and he can do that.
8 years old. Not only can he do it blindfolded, he can do it with his toes.
No.
Yes. You got to look at this kid. Wow. His first name is Chad. I can't remember.
I don't even know what to say to that, Terry.
And he can do it
I'm at a loss.
He can do it with one hand.
Oh, you got me with toes, dude. you had me at toes. You didn't need to go any farther. One-handed
as well.
Oh, so if you want to see an 8-year-old kid solve a Rubik's Cube with his toes.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
go to the show notes.
His name is Chan Hong Lik, L-I-K.
All right. If you're at all on Facebook or Twitter or any kind of social media, you've probably seen this blow up. Not too long ago, a group of evangelical leaders came together to issue a statement on what they believe is the biblical view on sexuality and gender.
The group in question is the Council of Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, which, by the way, is led by a friend of Apologize Canada, a guy we've actually had out to the conference, Denny Burke.
Right. And so the so-called Nashville statement, because it was signed in Nashville, Tennessee, came out not too long ago, and you can imagine the uproar in the media and social media. And there have been lots of heated exchanges back and forth, and
everything, not just the content of this statement, but actually the name. In fact, the mayor of Nashville, she was quite upset.
Yeah, she basically disassociated the whole city from anything that has to do with this statement.
Right.
Because it is seen as so bigoted and intolerant. And so
what is this statement? I mean, it's pretty fascinating, hey?
Yeah.
This statement has gained so much anger.
Because if you read it, the content, at least, there's nothing surprising about it. In fact, the Babylon Bee actually said something.
Oh, theirs was hilarious what they had to say. That is worth a read.
We'll put that up on the show notes too, but it's a satire piece, right? Like, the Babylon Bee is a satire website, and so you can expect a lot of sarcasm in there. So with a lot of sarcasm, the piece says, it, meaning the Nashville Statement, says some really controversial stuff for Bible-believing Christians, like that God made Adam and Eve as, trigger warning, male and female, that marriage was created by God to be the union between one man and one woman, that he loves people with gender dysphoria and same-sex attraction, even if he doesn't approve of all of their actions, and that he offers his grace and mercy to sinners of all stripes. That's kind of the sense I got as I read the Nashville Statement. I'm like, this is pretty standard stuff.
Really standard stuff. And in fact, as I've read different people that are upset with it, most of the evangelicals I've heard that are upset with it, or that I've read that are upset with it, aren't upset with the content, and they'll make that caveat.
Right.
They'll say, listen, I'm not upset with the content. I'm upset about how it was presented, or the tone in which it was written. You often hear it. And I got to push back on that. When I read the statement, I was expecting it to be much more inflammatory. But when I read it is a doctrinal statement. It is a statement of both what they affirm and what they deny. And I know that that might come across as callous to some people and seeming very distant and very cold. But this is a doctrinal statement. And this is how doctrinal statements have been written all the time. Like, this is how a doctrinal statement is written. In fact, that's why they call it the Nashville Statement, is because when these sorts of documents were written, they would take the name of the city that they were written in, that where whatever council came together and wrote it, like we have for the Council of Nicaea. Terry would take me to task on this. He actually disagrees.
You know, I don't know if I disagree with regards to the statements. They are doctrinally sound for the most part. I've only read it through once. I only got it yesterday kind of thing and read it through. And there's nothing in there that I disagree with, right? I would push back on the sense of these statements and this tone of we affirm, we deny is kind of old-fashioned and antiquated.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I really think as a Christian statement, fine. Mm-hmm. But the press that has been put on this is going throughout our whole culture.
I'm glad you brought that up. I'm just curious, how would you see it done differently? How do you think, how should the statement have been put forward in such a way that people looking in from the outside, so to speak, might go, okay, well, I see your point. I disagree with you, but I see your point.
Right from the get-go, I was reading the preamble. I don't know if you guys read that.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
I think some of the use and the wording in that, there's two wordings in there that I really kind of felt like it was inflammatory, in the sense that it's kind of us against them. We are putting this up as a declaration. I mean, I think Denny Burke also said it's a dividing line.
Right.
Those kind of words to me are not helpful in our culture, I believe.
Right. I can appreciate that. I was reading a blog by Preston Sprinkle, who would call himself, I think this is fair, he would call himself a homosexual Christian, a non-practicing homosexual Christian. He chooses to remain celibate from homosexuality because he does believe that homosexuality is wrong, but he acknowledges that he has same-sex attraction. Mm-hmm. By the way, we'll need to get back to this because that is really one of the big dividing lines with regards to this statement. Right. Preston would really argue what you're arguing, Terry. And he was basically saying, listen, I agree with what was written. I just don't agree with the tone. And in fact, he even argued that, listen, that is a very antiquated, very old-fashioned way of writing a doctrinal statement. I don't know that we need to write them that way any longer in the modern age, and that perhaps we could have written it in a way that was much more friendly and welcoming and gracious towards people of same-sex attraction.
I mean, my position is coming from a cultural kind of relational position, probably like Preston as well, right?
Yeah.
I don't think
it's fostering. Yeah, because Preston wants to reach people, right?
Yeah, it's not fostering that relational come together, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, evangelicals in the past have really placed anybody with these struggling issues to the side. and almost, do I dare say it, dehumanize them,
mm-hmm.
right?
Well, and I think that that's absolutely fair. In a lot of churches, if somebody who's struggling with or is just in the homosexual lifestyle, and this was, I think, Preston's point as well, just saying that these people are going to get ostracized. They're not going to feel welcome at all. And in fact, a lot of Christians aren't even sure how to talk to them or would even talk to them. So, I mean, in that sense, yeah, I mean, that definitely is a challenge.
I think in our culture, too, these words, these Christian words that come through these statements, I don't think have any meaning to the secularist or, you know, the atheist. Like, they just don't even know what they are. So when they put in statements of two or three lines with no other explanation, that's a problem.
Now, I'm going to disagree on this because this is where I wanted to come back to it. I would agree with you, Terry, if this document was written to secular culture. Now, I might be wrong here, but I don't think that this was written to secular culture. I think that this was written to the church.
It's been written to the church.
Right.
But I'm just saying that it is through the media like none other.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So it is touching our culture.
In that sense, it is problematic.
If you think about it, they should have known, and I think they anticipated this, the initial signatories of the national statement.
And let's just pause there.
Let's
just pause there for a moment. People can sign this document if you're wondering what Steve is saying there.
Right.
And there were people who signed this, such as I believe J.I. Packer did. But you have people like Piper, Francis Chan, even people like Rosario Butterfield.
Rosaria Butterfield and Christopher Yuan.
Yeah.
We had out for our conference earlier this year.
Right. So that gives you an idea of just some of the heavy hitters that have signed this.
Right. And you have right there. Now, this is something that you'll never hear from the sort of the secular media, is that we have amongst the initial signatories, people like Rosaria Butterfield, who was formerly lesbian. And there's Christopher Yuan, who still is gay, but he's just a celibate, right? Like he lives a celibate lifestyle. And so there are these people who come from that background or who are still, you know, working with these same-sex attractions that look at this statement and go, yeah, this is something I can get on board with. This is faithful to the doctrine of the church.
See, now, here's where I think a statement like this is needed, and that is that this document has shown how much division there actually is in the church over this issue. One of the things I find is that our culture is moving forward rapidly. Mm-hmm. Particularly here in Canada. It wasn't that long ago that it was out in Ontario that we heard that not just homosexuality, but transgender and even two-spirited and a number of other different sexual orientations.
Or gender identities
were being incorporated into students' curriculum in the school system. Mm-hmm. That has now moved out to British Columbia this year. It has now been incorporated into the curriculum out here in British Columbia. So my child out at school is going to get taught these mm-hmm. things. And so the question then becomes, well, what is the church doing to make a stance of what the church believes? Because secular culture is making their stance, and they are quite evangelistic in it. Well, what are we doing to stem that tide and to help our people to understand what we in fact do believe mm-hmm. and then graciously be able to live and argue for that?
I think that's the challenging part, right? I mean, for Terry, he has a fair point that when a statement like this is issued, the culture is going to notice, right? Especially because we have this heightened sense surrounding this issue. So when something like that comes out, they're going to take a look at it and go, wow, this is so bigoted and things like that. And that's the kind of response that we should expect.
But isn't it funny, though, that we don't get that same response back towards secular culture when they rolled out how they're going to incorporate this into student curriculum? There was no graciousness. There was no accommodating Christians in this.
That's the problem, right? So on the other hand, what we're often forgetting, I think, around this statement, Nashville statement, is that it doesn't come out of a vacuum. It's a reaction against something. And the reaction against what that something is the secular culture that has been pushing really hard on the issues of sexuality and things. And it was quite heavy-handed in a lot of ways, you know, with the Obergefell decision, where, you know, the Supreme Court basically legislated from the bench, mm-hmm. right? Five unelected lawyers basically making law for the entire country and curricula being pushed on. Like, for example, just a little while ago in Sacramento, there was this one kindergarten teacher who had a gender reveal ceremony where there would be a boy. She would introduce him in front of the whole class. And this is, say, Tommy, you know, he's a boy, such and such. And then she takes him to the bathroom where the boy gets changed into a dress or something like that, comes out. And now this is a gender reveal, right? This is, you know, say, Jessica, you know, she's a girl and things like that. And now, not only was the content of what was done controversial, but it was the fact that they did this behind the backs of the parents. They didn't even notify the parents, right? And so the parents are coming out saying, I want to be the one teaching my children about gender. Some kids, quite honestly, they came back from the kindergarten shaking, afraid, confused, asking, Mommy, I'm a girl, but am I going to turn into a boy?
Right.
Right? When stuff like that is happening, nobody seems to really care a whole lot except on this side of the dividing line, so to speak, right? People who find themselves on this side of the issue. And then something like the national statement comes along and it just blows up, right? So all that to say, this is a reaction to something, and this is, as far as I can see, it's a way of, okay, this is our position. This is where we stand, right?
Yeah, and one of the signers basically said, you know, we need to show culture that this biblical mandate, right, of what a relationship should be, men and women, right? So it wasn't so much a Christian document. I mean, I think they wanted it to be a statement, pushback of what the culture is saying. It was so short and so with Christian jargon that I don't know if it's effective anyway.
On your point, Terry, one of the things that I noticed about this that I would critique about it and say, Denny and others that were part of this, you really should have sought more people in coming on board with this, such as guys like Preston Sprinkle and others going, hey, you know, here's this document, and at least have gotten their feedback. You know, maybe they did, but from what I understand, from what, you know, Preston Sprinkle hadn't even heard of this document until 3 days after it came out. So I know that they didn't, you know, approach people. Somebody like Preston Sprinkle, he was one of the keynote speakers at ETS a couple years ago, which I know Denny and others participate in ETS quite regularly. That's the Evangelical Theological Society. So clearly this, you know, somebody like Preston is a leading voice with regards to this. And you should have, you know, I just think doing your due diligence, you'd want to incorporate people like that into a document like this.
Right.
So if I were to, you know, if I were to say, oh, here's a critique, I guess, you know, that might be it. Mm-hmm. By the way, yes, I think that the document could have been more gracious if you want, but it still was gracious as well. It goes out of its way to explain that people that have embraced a homosexual lifestyle or transgender, that these are in fact people made in the image of God, loved by God, people to be loved. You know, there was absolutely no hint, and I think you'd agree, Terry, no hint of any sort of animosity or hatred.
No, not at all.
In the document.
No.
It's just very clear of what Christianity teaches and what it does not
teach. It's a far step for me from this statement to actually relational interaction with people.
Yeah.
Having conversations. So last weekend or the weekend before, I was at my brother-in-law's girlfriend's birthday party in Vancouver. They have a variety of friends. There was a homosexual couple there being very affectionate through the whole time. We were in the pool. We went up to the apartment. So having conversations in this situation, I hope they're seeing that the graciousness of me in interacting with them. Well, at one point in time, we were near the table. My wife had made some deviled eggs. And one of the guys comes up and says, hey, I really like your deviled eggs. I could have at that point and said, well, you know, you're probably serving the devil or something, But, you know, we had this conversation out of, you know, these deviled eggs that my wife had made. He was asking, like, you know, what was in the ingredients and back and forth conversation. I mean, some people are very uneasy about those.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, that's fair enough. I think one of the things that I always tell people who, especially like youth who ask me, well, I have a friend who's gay or lesbian or transgender, like, what do I do with them? I'm like, just treat them like your friends, any other friends. Why are you so afraid of them?
You shouldn't be confused on how to treat them.
Right.
Here's the problem, though, that I see. Absolutely, you should love these people. The problem that Christians have is they don't understand how to love somebody and disagree with somebody at the same time.
And I don't think that's just Christians either.
No, absolutely not. It tends to be everybody right now.
Right.
But particularly Christians. I had a Christian come up to me recently. Came up to me at church and said, hey, Andy, do you have a moment? I just want to talk to you. And I said, yeah, sure, absolutely. You know, what's up? And she goes, you know, hey, could you help me understand how I, you know, the whole homosexuality and transgender thing? She goes, I'm really confused on what to think about this issue. And I'm like, oh, I go, well, tell me, what are you thinking? And she goes, well, a lot of my favorite shows have homosexuals in the show. And I actually really like them. Mm-hmm. And she goes, in fact, I'm watching this one show that is a reality TV show, and it has a homosexual couple that is in the process of trying to adopt a child. And she goes, and I find myself cheering for them to adopt this child. And I'm wondering, you know, how should I feel about all this? Right. And I go, and I think to myself, that's the trouble, right? We've got people that loving interacting with homosexual people, but they're having a difficult time understanding what Christianity teaches and why it teaches, because it comes across as bigoted. It comes across as angry and harmful. And so this is where I think, man, a document like this is needed in our culture, in our Christian culture, to start dialogues with church inside the church about how we are to understand this. I mean, you two were recently at a school. We won't name what school it is, but recently at a Christian school. And that Christian school basically said one of the biggest questions students are asking is on homosexuality.
Yeah, they told us that when Christopher Yuan was here, just about all of their students who came to the conference went straight to his sessions. Because they really wanted to hear from somebody who is gay but lives a celibate, faithful Christian life.
Even the other day when we did that Q&A on our podcast with questions that high schoolers had written in, after the podcast, we went through those and looked through the rest. I mean, it was a thick stack. And a number of them were on homosexuality and transgender.
Right.
See, I would argue that our culture knows what we stand for in a sense. But we've become irrelevant and intolerant for the most part.
In their eyes, you mean?
In their eyes. Right. Like, whatever sense they're getting it from TV, from other podcasts, or what, we're displayed as something that this God is against homosexuals and that kind of stuff.
Oh, without question, this is what's happening on both sides. Mm-hmm. We are getting very good at painting the right and left, and even calling it the right, you know, the right and left, or whatever it might be. We get very good at painting those people, whoever they are, whether we're talking about an evangelical or somebody in the transgender community, we get very good at painting those people with the kind of brush we want to paint them so we can see them the way that we want to see them. And if you guys noticed on the news that's been going out on this, that is exactly what's been done. Mm-hmm. A lot of news agencies publishing and saying the sorts of things that they would like to paint people of the Nashville, you know, statement like.
Right. I just wanted to make a point about the ultimate apologetic, and that's what William Craig calls your life, right? I think more than statements, our life as a Christian in everyday walk as we interact with the other people is going to be the ultimate apologetic.
Right.
And I see that being more effective than statements that are short and, you know, not understandable.
But here's the challenge to that. The Apostle Paul talks about this in Colossians chapter 1 with regards to your faith. And your faith is going to be lived out by the confidence of the hope that you have.
Yeah.
It's the truth that it's based on.
Yeah.
And my concern for a church is, how confidently are they going to live out their faith in this sort of apologetic you're talking about when they don't know what the truth is? Then they're confused on what the Bible actually teaches on a specific subject.
That's where we come in. Three of us.
And I think, again, Terry, like you bring up a really good point. I absolutely agree with you in many ways. I remember Ravi Zacharias always uses that Indian proverb, right? There's no point in cutting off somebody's nose and then giving them a rose to smell. In other words, how you communicate the message often has a lot to do with how that message is going to be received. I get that. Having said that, also, I think the purpose of this statement is to more lay out what we think is the scriptural truth rather than using this as a means of evangelizing other people. I don't think that's what the purpose of this statement is.
Right.
Of course, if you're going to use this statement, this short, pithy stuff, I mean, there's volumes that have been written on surrounding this issue, so there's no way you can put all of that in a short statement like this, right? Connecting with what you were talking about earlier, Andy, about painting people into different groups, what you said, Terry, earlier about, you know, us versus them kind of thing. In a sense, I think there has to be that us versus them mentality in the sense that there are different sides to the issue. And if I hold to a certain position on this issue and you hold to a different position on this issue, there is going to be that us versus them, not because we want to separate ourselves, but because that's just the nature of truth propositions, right?
Like, truth is exclusive.
Right. And so whether my position is true or your position is true, now that's something that we're going to have to communicate with each other across the dividing line, I think. And just if I may just wrap up this thought I had earlier, what you were saying about painting people into different groups, for me, it's a lot like talking to somebody about their religion. So, for example, when I come up to a Buddhist, now I have a certain idea as to what a Buddhist might believe in, what Buddhism might be like. But when I actually talk to that person, I hold to it very tentatively because that person might not necessarily believe in everything that I learned through a textbook. So my job is to first find out what this person believes. And so, I have this general idea.
Yeah.
Because it's really easy to, on an emotional issue like this, it's really easy to demonize the other side. Oh, those LGBTQT affirming Christians or those bigoted, you know, evangelical Christians or whatever. But I don't want to necessarily ascribe malicious intent on either side. I think they both sincerely believe that what they hold to is true. Now we need a dialogue.
A dialogue, so yeah.
And we know Denny Burke. We know that he's not malicious in his intent.
Yeah. I have a friend who is LGBTQ affirming, who is Christian. So when I talk to him, now I have an idea as to what he's going to say or what he believes in, just because I know he lands on that side of the argument. But when I actually talk to him, I will put that on reserve and I say, okay, what do you actually think? You tell me in your words what you think is true on this issue.
I find it very unfortunate that this happened after Trump took out transgender in the military. I mean, it almost seems like it's connected somehow.
I just have a problem with that, though, because people say, I can't believe that they let this out after the hurricane or whatever it is. It's like, I mean, come on. When is the, like, it's not like they desired for a hurricane to hit Houston and then thought this is the perfect time to release this. I mean, and he responded to this. He said, listen, we've been working on this for a year. This was when it was going to launch and we launched it.
Yeah, that's why I said unfortunate, because it happened afterwards and it was just like everybody jumped on it, probably because of that as well.
Yeah.
Getting back to this idea of truth, though, and where do we stand on this issue? The reality is that there is a divide in the church over this subject, and there's a couple different. Now, one we can't get into, but I'll just let you be aware of it, and that is that people like Denny Burke, who was the head of writing this thing, he holds that homosexuality is sinful, but also having homosexual thoughts or orientation or desires is also sinful. And if you're wondering, well, how's that? What do you mean? He would argue in the same way that having an affair is sinful, well, so are lustful thoughts to have the affair would be sinful. However, there's others, though, that would disagree with this, like Preston Sprinkle, who would say, no, the act of homosexuality is sinful. Having the homosexual desires is not sinful. So wherever you land on that, I don't want to get into that subject right now, but you just need to understand that that is one of the reasons why evangelicals aren't all green on this subject, is because it is written towards the stance that having the thoughts are sinful. So that changes the flavor of how the statement gets written. The other thing, though, that began with this, and I think this was actually one of the intended desires, is to show that there are churches out there that disagree on this subject, and that perhaps we need to start seeing who is in agreement and who's not in agreement in the evangelical church. Or the they would just say the church, right? Because that becomes the big question then here. Is this an orthodox issue about whether or not you are Christian or not, depending upon if you agree to the Nashville Statement? So a church in Denver called A House for All Sinners and Saints put out their own statement immediately. I'm amazed at how fast they were able to put this out, called the Denver Statement. And I'll just give you a flavor of what it says. So in Article 1, the Nashville Statement says, "We affirm that God has designed marriage to be a covenantal, sexual, procreative, lifelong union of one man and one woman as husband and wife, and is meant to signify the covenant love between Christ and his bride, the church. We deny that God has designed marriage to be a homosexual, polygamous, polyamorous relationship. We also deny that marriage is a mere human contract rather than a covenant made before God." So in juxtaposition to that, the Denver Statement reads, "We affirm that God has created humanity out of love and for the purpose of love. We deny that God intends marriage as a gift only to be enjoyed by those who happen to be heterosexual, cisgender, and fertile." Gives you a bit of a flavor. I'll read one more. I won't juxtapose them, though. So the Denver one says this for statement two. "We affirm that God created us as sexual beings in endless variety. We deny that the only type of sexual expression that can be considered holy is between a cisgender, heterosexual, married couple who waited to have sex until they were married. But if you fit into that group, good for you. We have no problem with your lifestyle choice."
When I read that, what comes to my mind is, just as Rosaria Butterfield said, the issue here isn't so much same-sex marriage, homosexuality, and transgenderism. The issue, at least within the Christian circles, is what we believe Scripture teaches about these things. So Scripture
absolutely
is the issue.
Absolutely. And by the way, this was one of the critiques of the Nashville Statement, is that it does not include any Scripture, which I thought was an interesting critique. Although I would argue that it is biblical, although they, for some reason, right, chose not to put any verses behind anything that they said.
Yeah. See, this is an issue that we could literally talk all day about, but unfortunately, we're out of time here. We're already well over time.
Hopefully, that just gives you some idea of what's being talked about and helps you think through this issue better.
Right. And so, even though we'd love to talk about this longer, we must say adios for now. Thank you for joining us, listeners. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada. As we wrap up, again, for those of you who have given us some good ratings on iTunes, we thank you for that. If you want to continue to help us, if you haven't done it already, please do go to iTunes and give us a good 5-star rating, if you can do so in your good conscience. Yep. Thank you again for all of your support. We'll see you next week. Ciao for now.